So while people are struggling in, let me just, this is, I guess, the last day for many people. So I want to thank those of you who are finishing your time at the program for coming. This is really great to have you all here. And it's certainly been very enriching for me and inspiring to see so many great pieces of work being done and new ideas and lots of things to think about. And so I certainly will come away much more energized by this program, despite my physical exhaustion, than I expected to be. So it's really great. So thank you. And the other thing I forgot to mention sort of early in my welcome to everybody is that some of you may know I'm now directing a new center at UMass called the Amherst Center for Fundamental Interactions. And it is a five-year funded center by the university, and we're sort of living physics-wise at the interface of what we call the three frontiers in the U.S., energy, intensity, and cosmic frontiers. And anyone is welcome to ask to come visit and or propose a workshop, which is one of the things that we do. And now I get to feel like a used car salesman and tell you I have things to hand out about the center. There's also a nice website, so if you want to read our glossy, please do that. In fact, one of the topics I'll talk about today, we just had a workshop in Amherst that was really quite energizing and constructive. So, all right, so with that sort of little propaganda aside, so the request that came was to have a talk about classes of models that give an electroweak phase transition, types of electroweak phase transition. So I'm going to try to do that today sort of very informally. Tell you a little bit about some of the physics of electroweak phase transition from a somewhat different perspective than Tim Cohen did during the first week. And since some of you weren't here during Tim's talk, this won't necessarily be review, but for others of you it might be. The outline is I'm going to say a few things about general features, and then I'm going to concentrate on two classes of models, what I'll call Higgs portal scenarios, and I'll talk about two types. Those involving gauge singlet degrees of freedom and then non-singlet degrees of freedom. And then I'll talk very briefly about loop-induced phase transition physics, partly because Tim talked about this during the first week. And also Carlos will be talking next week about supersymmetric baryogenesis, where loops will be presumably a key issue. So I'll just highlight a few features, but I won't go into great detail because we already have some talks. And then at the end, I want to say a little bit about ideas of how the CP violating part of these phase transitions might work when you introduce scalar sector extensions, which is less developed than the phase transition part. But this is, since this is a sort of workshop type environment, it's a good opportunity to get some comments and feedback. And just very, I guess, sort of self-interestedly, most of the stuff I'm going to talk about is in papers that I'm a co-author on. So I've listed them here, but there's one really nice sort of set of summer school lectures, I guess, by Mariano Quiros in 1999, where I started to learn about phase transition physics. And I'll put this, all of these references on the wiki, but this is the archive number for that. And it's really a very clear set of lectures. Okay, so let me start by saying a few things about sort of in general. And again, in the spirit of our informal talks, this is really an occasion for discussion, not to have people sit and listen to me and fall asleep. So the first thing I want to do is make contact with the issues for electroweak baryogenesis. And as we've been discussing, there are really two sets of issues. One is the so-called baryon number preservation criteria, which I'll abbreviate by BNPC. And the key ingredient there is the rate for the sphalerons inside the phase of broken symmetry, gamma sphaleron, which apart from a prefactor goes like an exponential of the sphaleron energy as a function of temperature over temperature. And this sphaleron energy depends on a scale which I call V bar of T. And it's suggestive of a vacuum expectation value, but it's not exactly the vacuum expectation value. The bar is meant to alert you to the fact that to do this analysis in a gauge invariant way in perturbation theory, this can't really be the exact vacuum expectation value of the full affected potential. So this is a gauge invariant energy scale. And so there are really two quantities of interest from this standpoint that one is concerned about. One is V bar of T, and the other is the temperature of the transition, which really ought to be the temperature at which bubbles nucleate, but most people use the critical temperature, and that's what I'll use, because it's a little easier to figure out what that is than the nucleation temperature. So you can see that the sphaleron rate is decreased as the ratio of the energy to temperature is increased, and that's good for preserving the baryons because there's less washout. Another consideration, which I won't talk much about here, but the Kyros lectures are actually very nice in their discussion of this physics, is the nucleation. Nucleation depends on the tunneling rate, gamma sub n, and it goes like an exponential of minus the three-dimensional action, effective action over the temperature, and S3 is equal to, it's not twiddle, it's equal to integral over all space of the kinetic energy associated with the scalar field plus the effective potential at finite temperature. And again, one has to take some care in calculating that in a gauge invariant way. But what you want, you can see you want a large ratio of E over T, but you don't want too large a ratio of S3 over T, because you have to have enough rate to make the bubbles, but you have to have enough energy, which means smaller S3 over T, but you have to have enough energy to prevent the washout that occurs once you're inside the bubble. Okay, so you want very roughly large E sphaleron over T and small-ish S3 over T. So in this talk, because I'm really trying to keep it rather simple, and I've worked more on the first part, I'm going to concentrate on the first criteria here, which is often what you see discussed in the phenomenology literature. And we're going to take T be approximately to be equal to Tc, which is usually a little bit above the nucleation temperature, according to people's analyses. Okay. Now let's think then, since we're concentrating on the sphaleron energy, about where these the scale and the temperature come from. So I want to do that by studying the finite temperature effective potential in the high temperature effective theory. Yes.
Could you explain for the nucleation rate why, if the action is larger, it is suppressed? Like, I'm not an expert on this thing, so.
Why, let's see, if there's a good physical intuition as to why the nucleation rate. I don't have a good sort of intuitive explanation. Maybe someone who's worked on this more than I have does. Why do you expect the nucleation rate to go down with larger effective action? It's a tunneling effect,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Isn't it that when you have a larger barrier,
when you have a larger,
it's larger, and then you tend to want to.
Yeah.
Stay.
So that's how I would think about it. There's, you know, you've got to overcome this kinetic energy that's keeping you from getting into the place with the lower potential energy, right? So you reduce S3 by making V more negative relative to the kinetic energy, right? So it likes to go tunnel to the lower energy state, despite having some kinetic energy associated with the scalar field.
So this is why when you have like a tree level barrier, sometimes you can get stuck because the tunneling rate is just
okay. That's probably as good an intuitive. So maybe I should say this is sort of tunneling physics. Okay, so let's look at very schematically what V effective looks like in the high temperature effective theory. And the reason I'm using the high temperature effective theory is because I want to maintain explicit gauge invariance, as per our discussion in week one. And so I'm going to take it to have the following form. There's a quadratic term with a temperature-dependent negative mass squared times phi squared. In general, you can have a cubic term, which I'll normalize to 3, and a quartic term. And let's just, because I'll refer back to equations, call that equation 1. So what is this mu squared of t? So mu squared of t has two terms. It has the term that we're used to from zero temperature physics, which we often call mu squared, minus what's called a thermal mass correction, some constant A times T squared. So this is this comes from loops. And there are various classes of contributions. Let me write down the graphs. So there can be fermion loops. Call this F sub J. There can be gauge loops. I guess that's what I want, yep. So we'll call that A sub J. And there can be scalar loops. And let's call this phi sub k. And so this A constant is just equal to a sum over some loop factor for each case, A sub J for the fermions times a Yukawa coupling squared plus a sum over all the gauges, gauge bosons, A sub J gauge boson times the gauge coupling squared. And then these graphs, you can see, come with a linear dependence on the I'll call this a sum over, because I called this k for some reason, lambda sub k, the sort of quartic interactions. That's not what I want, just lambda sub k.
Yeah.
Okay? And it's been proven in various ways that these calculations give you a gauge invariant coefficient. So this is a safe thing for us to do, is to write down this quadratic term. So you can study how this potential behaves with temperature, and let me sketch it out graphically. So I want to study the T evolution, and it sort of looks like this. So I'll put the potential here, and this is phi, and we know at very high temperature the lowest energy state is at the origin, so this is 0. At some temperature, I call T naught. Just below that, the potential starts to develop another minimum. So this is T greater than T naught. At T just below the temperature T naught, which I'll define shortly, a secondary minimum develops. And as it cools down, eventually this minimum drops and becomes degenerate with the minimum at the origin, the unbroken phase. So this is called the critical temperature. And then just below the critical temperature, T less than TC, somewhere just below is when the nucleation occurs, because this is the energetically favorable place to go. And I didn't draw this very well at all. Yeah, this is kind of ridiculous there. Okay. So let's study this now analytically, and just to be very sort of simple-minded about it. So if I solve the minimization condition, dV by d phi equals to 0, I have two solutions. I have phi equals to 0, and then I have another class of solutions I'll call phi plus minus of t, which can be written in terms of these parameters, little e plus or minus e squared plus 4 lambda times mu squared of t, all square root, divided by 2 lambda. Okay. So let's ask what happens, the behavior of this solution as a function of temperature. When t is greater than t naught, what you find is that this discriminant is negative, and so there's no solution. And so you only have the solution at the origin. But for t less than t naught.
So isn't there for t naught not defined as the place where the second derivative and the derivation vanish? Or what is your definition?
It's just it's going to be the definition of where this goes to 0.
Okay.
which is the next line in this. Okay, so we're going to define T naught by the condition that for lambda u of t squared plus e squared is equal to 0. And so you can solve that T naught squared is equal to 1 over A, when all is said and done, times mu squared plus e squared over 4 lambda. And that I want to be equation 4. Okay? So now let me substitute equation 4 into equation 3, because T naught is I'm going to rewrite equation 3 in terms of T naught, and what I find, and I'll write this over here, is that phi plus minus is equal to e over 2 lambda plus or minus 1 over 2 lambda times a times T naught squared minus T squared square root. Okay? So again, you see that when T is above T naught, this makes no sense, so you only have the phi equals 0 solution, okay? So then we can plot, for t less than t naught, then this quantity here gives us an energy scale. And it's this quantity that sets the scale of the Sphaleron energy. So this, in this setup, the v bar of t would be that solution. Okay, so it's not exactly the vacuum expectation value of the full potential, but it is the vacuum expectation value of the potential in the high temperature effective theory, which is gauge invariant. So let's substitute, where do I want to put this? Yeah, I want to make a little plot of equation 5, so I can erase equation 3. And let's take the phi plus solution just for illustrative purposes. See what it looks like. So here's going to be phi plus of t. And here is t. And you can see that at t equals to t naught, the value of phi plus is e over 2 lambda. And then it goes to some larger value at temperature below that, and somewhere over here is the critical temperature. So let's see what happens to this energy scale as we vary the parameters in the potential. Remember, for successful baryogenesis, we want this energy scale to be as large as possible, and we want the critical temperature, or really the nucleation temperature, to be as small as possible so that we have the most effective baryon number preservation. So you can see that the energy scale will increase with increasing E over lambda. So in the potential, you want to somehow either increase this cubic coefficient as much as you can, and or decrease the quartic self-coupling. Now in the community people who worked in this field for a long time, it's been well known that the effect of the cubic coupling is important, but maybe a little less appreciated that the effect on the quartic self-coupling can also do the job for you, depending on the scenario. Okay? So the name of the game, in a sense, is to do this. And through the parameters that go into T naught, try to increase the distance between T naught and TC, because the lower the critical temperature with respect to T naught, the larger the energy scale as well. So you can either do it through this or somehow through T naught by what you're doing with the thermal mass corrections. Okay? So that's going to be kind of the key for the rest of this talk, I think. So let me stop and see if there are any questions. Vincenzo.
Question, maybe you repeated that
this is not the full effective potential, but
correct.
The high energy effective. Can you elaborate a little bit on that? I missed the discussion in the first three.
So if I would do this in the full potential and solve for the vacuum expectation value, then I would get a gauge dependence.
Yeah, but why isn't that the full potential? What is that?
Well, what's missing here, we'll come to this a little bit, there are thermal corrections, there are T-dependent corrections that are here and here and plus dot, 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 mm-hmm. that carry a gauge dependence. The most serious one for the purposes of our discussion will come in here. And so I haven't included those in this high temperature effective theory. They would come in, and this is looking a little bit ahead, there would be something that would look like E that would be another coefficient, E times T. So it's linear in T. So in the high temperature effective theory, it's subdominant compared to the quadratic terms. And then they're going to be log T dependences and 1 over T. I've thrown all that stuff away.
So this just comes from the expansion of the thermal functions, right? These J plus T.
Yeah. So when you do the full thermal loops, these graphs, and keep all the terms, you get these non-analytic dependencies.
Okay, fine. But it's subdominant compared to the T squared. But it could it ever compete with the T-level E? I mean, the E you're keeping?
Depends on the value of E. Right. Yes, it could. So I'm going to come to that. So I'm trying to do this a little bit carefully, because in the standard model, you don't have this except through finite temperature. But the problem is that is in this expansion gauge dependent. So it's not good for our intuition. So I want to start in a situation where I have the manifest gauge invariance. John.
So in practice, I don't always want to use this high temperature effective theory. So is there a clean way of sort of figuring out what terms to keep so that I maintain gauge invariance, like if I'm working with the full.
So in this paper, we essentially rediscovered what some people had pointed out long ago, which is that you can consistently use the full effective potential if you do the following thing. Start with your, whatever your gauge invariant tree level potential is, find the minimum, compute the one loop potential, and take the tree-level solution and substitute that in. That will give you explicit gauge invariance. You can do that at zero temperature, or you can even do it at finite temperature. For example, if I were to take this potential and find that solution, phi plus minus, and then I take the remaining corrections and solve and substitute the tree-level solution, this would be
the
tree-level
potential. Putting the tree-level masses into the
tree-level every solution for phi into the one-loop potential. It turns out. And you can do this order by order, and it's an H-bar expansion, effectively. And it, you know, one can have a discussion about how realistic that is in terms of getting the right answer, but at least it gives you manifest gauge invariance, and so your perturbation theory makes sense. Whether or not it's a realistic, numerically realistic is another question. Yeah, no.
So is there any intuitive explanation why this quadratic correction is gauge invariant but not the...
Well, you think of a mass as, imagine an experiment where you can measure a mass, right, as a pole. A cubic term has no interpretation as a physical observable, to my knowledge, or as a pole in a Green's function. Now, there are formal proofs that this is true, but that's certainly probably the best I can do. Okay, So what I want to concentrate on, because the question had come up, you know, what are the models that give you a strong first order phase transition? Now, in this context, strong means, we'll forget about this for the moment, satisfying this sort of washout criteria, which means doing increasing E over lambda or getting T naught larger than TC as much as you can. Okay, so how do you choose your model parameters and setup or model construction, not just the parameters, to do that? Okay. So maybe I can, let's see. I think I can probably, well, I'm not sure what I want to erase. This is probably clear enough now. I think I'll erase this and talk about really the simplest model illustration that hopefully will give us some intuition. More complicated cases. And these are going to go under these headings of Higgs portal extensions. So, and I'm going to start with the really simplest case of adding one real scalar, an SU2 left, well, a standard model gauge singlet. And I can write down a potential that involves the standard model Higgs and the singlet S. I'm just going to write down the part that contains the inverse. Yeah, sure.
So most of the gauge dependence comes from the Goldstone contributions?
It comes, well, Goldstone and gauge boson, yeah.
But for instance, if you go to a standard model, those contributions are weak, so we never affect the strongly for solid free transition, right?
Well, it depends on the gauge you choose.
What do you mean the gauge you choose?
Well, it depends, it's a gauge parameter. So to be quantitative about it.
And the couplings are small, yes?
So what you find, however,
so
but.
The nature of a solid free transition will not be gauge dependent. Because those things cannot bring us
time. That's what you would think. And so when Stefano and his former student Max Wainwright and I, we did a couple studies that I didn't list here of.
Unless they found an infrared.
No, it wasn't an infrared. It was. We explicitly studied in the abelian Higgs model, which is really simple.
No, I'm talking about the standard model.
I know, but it's a lot like it.
I studied it. Okay, tell me.
And the answer was, we were looking at gravity wave signatures, and we found that you could actually change the phase structure by changing the gauge parameter.
But let's go to the real model, the standard model. So then these things are weak. Then how would they affect the first solid phase transition? So nothing, no gauge dependence can affect the nature of first solid phase transition. You need new physics that is.
So if you do this in the high temperature effective theory in the standard model, this coefficient E goes something like 2 minus the gauge parameter to the 3/2 power. Just do the explicit calculation. So usually people choose Landau gauge, you get 2. I choose a slightly different gauge, I get 0.
That's fine, but it's irrelevant anyway.
Why?
That contribution to a first order phase transition is negligible.
This is the full cubic term in the high temperature effective theory.
Yes. What I'm saying is
then you don't have a first order phase transition if that term isn't there in that limit.
Sorry, but I'm talking about this term is the term proportional to a gauge coupling, to a weak gauge coupling, right?
Yeah. But what I'm saying.
That term is small anyway.
It certainly is small, but in terms of getting a difference between a first and a.
The solution comes from the fact that the Goldstone modes acquire a mass that if psi.
Yeah. No.
So
I
that is the origin of that contribution.
But so if I don't have this term,
yes,
then I don't have a barrier.
I want to have that term, but I'm saying that those.
That's the only origin.
The gauge-dependent contributions are not the relevant ones.
No, this is the full. This whole thing multiplies.
In the standard model,
squared 3g squared plus g prime squared.
Yes, but in the standard model, that is not the leading meter of first order phase transition.
Only because the Higgs is not heavy enough, is not light enough.
Right. So, but the Higgs is not light enough.
Yeah, but that's a
it's
different.
A fact. I mean,
but that's a different point.
No, it's not a different point. I'm asking about practical things. This Higgs dependence is not relevant for studying the phase transition of the real theory.
Well, so the real theory we now agree is not the standard model because you're not interested in the standard model. You just told me.
Exactly. The standard model. No, I'm telling you, the standard model contribution is not. To the cubic contribution.
To the cubic contribution.
Yes.
So.
Okay,
let's No. Let me just. No. You know.
I'm talking
small.
About
small. Small becomes a quantitative question, right? If, and this goes back to Vincenzo's question, really. If E is not large enough, then the gauge dependence becomes more serious.
Absolutely.
And so then it's a quantitative question.
Okay.
But I don't trust any calculation that has a gauge dependence in it.
Okay, very good.
Because you tell me that you're going to choose squiggly to be 10, then the standard model contribution starts to get larger. And what tells me 10 is more or less reasonable than 0?
Okay, let's just.
I don't, as a field theorist, I couldn't buy a calculation that knowingly kept gauge dependence.
Instead of stopping the discussion too far. So basically, Okay, I don't know if you agree. It seems from what he says that basically if the Fresnel, the strength of Fresnel transition is driven by Gauge bosons.
I don't understand this. I don't believe that psi 2.5 is the right coefficient, by the way. But I think that those coefficients should be resummed and cannot. That I have to read in detail.
That's coming from the ring resummation.
Of the Goldstones?
Yep. It's the full calculation, Carlos.
Okay. We
So you can believe that part. We can argue over whether it's relevant or not in different models.
No, I understand that what's going on. I believe I understand the reason of that.
Yeah, it's certainly coming from it comes from the Goldstones and the. And certainly it comes with the gauge couplings, but then if E is small, you have to worry about it.
I say that the things that couple weakly to the Higgs, if you find a strength for solid transition from there, then certainly will be wrong, right? So cannot induce anything that will affect the phase transition in a strong way. But anyway, we can discuss that.
Okay. So you have no fire?
No, there's enough after the end of the book.
So maybe, you know, I guess it's partly a philosophical point of view. I think you can get the physics and do it in a gauge invariant way.
No, because we know that. It's fine. But we know that the lattice calculations agree roughly with the.
Yeah, and they also agree if you set it up in a.
So we know that is not the physics we have to care about if we want to study.
Well, so let me put it this way.
That we know that the gauge invariant calculations are.
Sure, the lattice I completely agree with. And if you read our paper.
Anything that brings that phase transition to be strong should be beyond standard model. And usually it doesn't lead with.
So we can agree on this. We can both use perturbation theory to indicate where we have models that might give us a strong first order phase transition and roughly what region of parameters are interesting.
Right.
I prefer to do that in a gauge invariant way.
Absolutely. Okay. Very good.
Okay, and so it's a point of principle, and so that's why if I were teaching a class in field theory, this is how I would teach it. Okay, but in terms of, and I don't know, you maybe didn't read the last part of our paper, but in the last part of our paper, what I said was perturbation theory is a poor guide anyway. And so what are you going to use perturbation theory for? You're going to use it to identify those scenarios that are likely to give first order phase transitions that work for baryogenesis, and what kinds of parameters are likely to work, what are the trends with the parameters, but to get a robust, believable answer, you've got to do the lattice.
I agree with that statement.
So that's the spirit in which I even think about using perturbation theory. Okay. But to build intuition and to be true to my sort of field theory principles, I got to do gauge invariant.
I think also Mike didn't doubt that the standard model doesn't give it to you. I think the question, as I understood you correctly, is how to treat this if you go beyond the standard model.
Well, if you would extend the gauge group and you would have some new gauge group that was coupling with large coupling to the Higgs, you would then reintroduce the problem and it might even be more serious.
So you can use the knowledge that you've taken the standard model as well.
Well, in most of these Higgs portal scenarios I'm going to talk about, we're not introducing new gauge symmetries. So you'll avoid the problem no matter what if you do it this way. But the problem of introducing new gauge bosons and the associated would-be Goldstone bosons and the ghosts that are giving you all the gauge dependence in the standard model will not be replicated. It's already there, and there's a way to treat it. And you know, then you have to use perturbation theory in a very sort of nuanced way. You know, what are you really learning from it? Now I get to be on my hobby horse. The thing that I've really objected to in the phenomenology papers are these really strong statements that say, if you're not in exactly this region of parameter space in this model, you don't have successful baryogenesis. And I think that's kind of ridiculous because perturbation theory is limited and the calculations weren't gauge invariant anyway, most of them. So what you ought to say is, here's the models that are likely to be good for you. Here's where you ought to look. Here's the associated phenomenology. And if this turns out to be what's realized in nature, then do this calculation in the expensive way, which is with Monte Carlo. And then you'll know what the answer is. Okay. All right, so now back to the classes of models. Let's talk about this simplest case, the real singlet. And I'm just going to write down the terms that are the so-called Higgs-Portal couplings. So there's going to be a cubic term and a quadratic term. And by the way, in this discussion, I've restricted myself to the case where phi plus of t is greater than 0. You can see there's potentially a solution where it's negative. So statements I make about signs in this discussion are going to be subject to that.
I got the square.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's not here. Yeah, thank you. So the, and I just want to note that for people doing dark matter, you know, if you have a Z2 symmetry, then A1 is equal to 0, and you have a stable particle, the S. But we're not interested in that case here, and you can see why, because I want, this is effectively a cubic interaction. So it's going to give us our little E. And in principle, here's a contribution to a quartic self-coupling. This is going to affect our lambda compared to what the standard model has. So you can already see that a lot of the interesting physics is built into this very simple extension. And so in particular, if A1 is less than 0, according to the way I chose the signs, that implies a positive E. And if A2 is less than 0, subject to stability requirements, then you can see that you're going to reduce the effective lambda. So this is, in general, what you want to do. Okay? A little bit about the, just the low-energy phenomenology, since many people here haven't thought about this before, but others of you have heard this talk probably a gazillion times. What do these things do? They generally lead, after electroweak symmetry breaking, when H is equal to V at zero temperature, then you can get HS mixing. So there are really two states, and there are consequences. You can have, this is sort of a little aside, you can have the mass hierarchy such that H1 is sort of standard model-like, could decay to H2, or it could be the reverse, the heavier state can be heavy enough to decay to two H1s, or neither, but you have two states with reduced standard model strength. So you can sort of see what the collider phenomenology already is.
You know, about tadpole problems in these models?
You have all kinds of divergences, so I'm not worrying about the hierarchy problem. Okay. And I guess I should have prefaced this discussion by saying, I'm going to take the sort of a bottom-up approach to identify what are the ingredients of models that you would build or look for that would give you the physics of the phase transition. So you can think about singlets, for example, in the complex singlet case being embedded in NMSSM, for example, where maybe you do have a solution to the hierarchy problem. But I want to strip away a lot of the other sort of paraphernalia and just focus on the heart of the scalar potential that might live in some of these extensions. So I'm going to assume all that stuff is ultimately there, but I don't want to get myself bogged down in it. Okay.
So that's the source of CP violation?
I haven't touched the CP violation yet. That comes in part four.
Okay.
So just to put water on your fire, yeah.
It's really on part two.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Part three will be very short, actually, because we're going to hear about it. Well, we've already had some discussion about it, but we're going to hear about it more next week. Okay. So maybe that's good enough. You can, you know, how one analyzes this phase transition in detail depends on the choices of these parameters as well as some of the other ones I haven't written down. I guess the thing I do want to say is that the analysis of the phase transition becomes more complicated because it's now a two-field problem. So we have to think about the pattern of symmetry breaking in this way. So here's V, here's the Higgs direction, here's the singlet direction. And you can imagine, you know, various patterns of symmetry breaking where You may be at high temperature break along the S direction first, and then you break to some point here, or you have some symmetry breaking that goes to a point where both S and H get VEVs. For this discussion here, it's this either of these two transitions that's really important, because we want something where all the fields in the cubic interaction are getting a BEV to affect the phi. Okay? If only the Higgs is getting a BEV, we really don't have a cubic term. Okay. And then the last point would be, once you get that VEV here, then it's really the projection on the SU2 direction that's important for the sphalerons, because the sphalerons couple the SU2 gauge bosons and the Higgs in this non-trivial topology. Okay, so you want this sort of VEV to live over here ultimately.
Here you avoid the problem of gauge invariance because you're doing this at tree level. You don't care. I mean, you just
I could really use this theory plus this theory, and I would be fine. In fact, this paper that Peter and I and Stefano and Max are finishing are doing that. But if you wanted to be more sophisticated about it, include all the thermal corrections and still maintain gauge invariance, then you'd follow the procedure we outlined here. And I actually agree that I don't think it would change the answer much, but you know, it would be at least satisfying to do it that way. Okay. Yes, Yemen.
Can you really add the bare mass term for S and the...
Oh, I've neglected. This is contains.
Oh.
There's plus dot, dot, dot. I didn't want to confuse everyone with all the other parameters, because I'm really focusing on what essentially in this spirit is driving that. But yes, there's any term you can write down that's allowed by SU2 hypercharge. And again, you can think of this as maybe being embedded in, you know, like the NMSSM type scenarios, NMSSM, or other extensions that have gauge singlets. And there's no reason why the scalar sector can't look like that. Okay, so maybe I can then go on and I want to keep this and this, so I'm going to, let's see, I think I can erase this now. I want to talk about non-singlets. So the simplest extension, where the scalar carries non-trivial electroweak only quantum numbers, is what's called the real triplet. And so there are three scalars, sort of like the pion in that sense. And you can write down an analogous potential. And now I'll include some of the other terms. So there's going to be a Higgs portal type setup. And let me define sigma here to be this vector dotted into the vector of generators of SU2. And then there are Yanu, there is certainly a bare mass term, and a quartic term, and I won't write down the standard model part, but we'll come back to this in a moment. Okay. I already lost my equation numbers here, but that's okay, it doesn't matter. Okay. So now, we have to think about these problematic thermal corrections, the ones that are not just quadratic. And I think I'll do that over here. And let's imagine for the moment that we could neglect the gauge problem. And then you have to worry about these contributions that would give you potentially loop-induced cubic terms, it turns out. And I'll show you why that's important in a moment. So we already agree it doesn't work in the standard model, but we're going to see in this case it actually might help you. The origin comes from the fact that you have to add up in the effective potential a whole infinite series of these kinds of graphs where you put little loops on top of the big loop. This is called the Daisy resummation or the ring sum. And it's just to maintain the power counting of this theory at the high temperatures. And what you find is I should have made one point over here. So you might look at this and you might say, aha, here's my E. Okay? But the problem with this is that if A1 is not equal to 0, that implies that the VEV of the neutral component is not 0, and that VEV can be non-zero, but it has to be very small by the constraints of the electroweak rho parameter. And it's something like sigma over, has to be less than about, just a few GeV.
May I ask a naive question?
Yes.
Is it difficult to prevent Xi-plus, for instance, from getting a web?
Difficult.
Maybe I would expect that any component can get this.
Well, I guess I can always gauge rotate, right? Too. Yeah. So the point is that what you thought might do the job for you, and this is really why I worry about the gauge problem, can't. Okay? In terms of increasing E. So we have to look at these problematic loop effects, and where they come from is from this ring sum, and there's a contribution to the effective potential, which I'll call delta V ring for this case, for the sigma, minus T over 12 pi. And there's a piece that involves the bare mass squared plus B4 times the VEV of sigma at finite temperature. So I'll call this sigma. So I'll write this as sigma of T squared plus the what's called the thermal mass function. It's called a pi function to the 3/2 power minus the same thing without the thermal mass. Okay. Now I've totally lost my equation numbering. This is supposed to be equation 10. That's okay. There was pages left as homework assignment between the last class and this one. So. Okay, so what the ring sum, so this term would actually be there in the naive effective potential. What the ring sum says is take it out and put back this one where you've replaced the mass by the thermal mass, which is m0 squared plus pi of t. Okay, and if we were in pure scalar field theory, I wouldn't have to worry about gauge dependence, those Goldstone contributions, but they have a gauge dependence in their contribution here. But the one that comes from sigma and its self-interactions does not, okay? So what do I want to say about this? So let's imagine now, suppose nature is kind to us and chooses m0 squared to be approximately minus pi sigma of t at some t, say of order 100 GeV, or wherever the transition is occurring. Okay. So then if you look at this term, what does it look like? It looks like sigma to the 3/2, sigma to the 3 power times t times some loop coefficient. So it looks just like E, where E is equal to what I'll call capital E sigma times T.
Everybody lost that. What is small sigma?
Small sigma is the VEV of capital sigma. So it's the VEV at finite temperature.
Okay.
So you can see that, roughly speaking, you get a loop induced cubic term, and therefore a first order transition is possible, even though the row parameter tells you you can't really do it very well with the Higgs portal coupling. Okay, and as we'll probably hear in Carlos's talk, this is essentially the reason why things work in the MSSM. Instead of sigma, you have the stop. This would be the stop soft mass parameter. This would be the thermal mass, and you get a loop-induced cubic term. So this is not new to this particular model. Okay. So what does this open up for you? This opens up for you the following possibility. And let me, where do I want to do it? I need to keep that for future purposes. So I'm going to do this over here. It opens up the possibility of a two-step phase transition history. So let's write our axes like this. V, H, and sigma. So you can imagine the following scenario, and this actually we showed actually can occur for the right choices of the model parameters, that you start at high temperature at the origin, and you first break electroweak symmetry by giving sigma a VEB at finite temperature. So this is step one. The rho parameter doesn't preclude the sigma VEB from being large at finite temperature, it just prevents it from being large at zero temperature. Then if the parameters in the potential work for you, a second step can occur to take you to our phase, the Higgs phase, where the rho parameter is satisfied, the triplet VEB is small, and life is good. Now, why is this interesting? So this is a two-step transition. And it could occur in the singlet model, but what makes this different is that once sigma gets a VEV, then it looks like you've given an energy scale to something that talks to the gauge bosons, which means Sphaleron energy would be large. And so in principle, you could imagine nucleating a bubble in the sigma phase, turning off Sphalerons, do all your baryogenesis here, and then, at somewhat lower temperature, you make another transition to the standard model phase. And as long as you don't re-excite the Sphalerons by being at sufficiently low temperature and dilute the asymmetry with a large entropy injection, then you've got successful baryogenesis. And so this is kind of a generic new idea. I didn't have to choose the sigma. I could have chosen any non-trivial representation of SU2 in the scalar sector, because it can get as large a VEB as it wants at finite temperature, and then it goes to zero subsequently. And it's pretty sort of generic with the choices of the model parameters to get this to work. So now there's a slight complication for this particular choice. We thought we were picking the simplest one. We weren't, it turns out, from a different standpoint, which is even though you think no Sphalerons here, it turns out you have a monopole solution. You have the Tuft-Veltman monopole. Because after you give the sigma a VEB, you have a residual U1 involving a global U1 involving the sigma plus and the sigma minus. And so you have to be careful that your monopole rate is small enough not to cause baryon number violation. The monopoles change B plus L by 2 units. To the extent that the monopole mass is given by this energy scale, phi plus, we can live on this term here and make phi plus large, suppress the monopole rate, and still have successful baryogenesis. Okay, and there's no constraints like you have from the Higgs mass in the standard model about making lambda small enough to get the energy large, because we haven't measured the mass of the sigma yet. It's not getting its mass in the same sort of way. Okay.
Does the sigma mass persist to today? Does the VEB persist today?
No, it does not.
It goes away.
It goes away in the second step. That's the whole point.
Does the sigma VEB break SU2 plus U1 entirely, or does it leave the U1 subgroup like?
It leaves this U1. It leaves the U1.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no color breaking here because this is neutral. I mean, no charge breaking here. Yeah.
Neutral.
It's neutral, right. But there is this global U1, so you get a monopole solution. So it's a other representations that we're thinking about don't have that feature that when you give the neutral component of EV, you have a residual global symmetry. And so they might actually be better. But this is the simplest number of degrees of freedom.
Is monopoles can contribute to dark matter?
Well, I haven't thought about this. It's an interesting question. I don't know. We didn't want them around because they destroy.
You have a fight. You have some amount, though, right? That's unavoidable.
I'm sorry.
It's unavoidable. You have some amount.
You'll have some amount, and they'll be sort of. There's two sources of monopoles. There's the sort of Boltzmann excitation of monopoles, and that is just then a Boltzmann factor. And then there's the sort of topology of breaking the symmetry that leads to it's like the saddle point for sphalerons.
I think somebody had a Cozy had a paper out last week on monopole, hidden sector monopole dark matter. That's what made me think about this.
Ah, okay.
These ones
will
be stable, once we get to our vacuum.
Once we get to our vacuum, it's a different U1.
That's true.
No, it's true. No, these monopoles have to go away.
That makes sense. Okay.
Okay, So we haven't talked about the CP violating part, which maybe I will or won't. We're doing okay in time.
Sorry, yes. In the end, what is the mass of the sigma?
Oh, the mass of the sigma. Okay, so the mass of the sigma, let's see, where did my potential go? You can see that the mass of the sigma is going to be m0 squared plus a2 the Higgs bev squared. This is going to be negative to get the symmetry breaking to occur, right, from our thermal effects. And so if A2 is order 1, then the masses are in the 1 to 300 GeV range. Of course, LEP gives you a lower bound because the charge states can't be seen. But they're light enough. They're difficult at the LHC, but not impossible at a higher energy collider. Electroweak production cross sections are not out of reach, so.
Are S and T okay?
S and T are fine, yeah.
So just to understand, what definition of parameters of this works then?
So A in the order of, this is dimensionless parameter, order of a few. It's not unreasonably large. And ultimately the masses for the sigma are in the sort of 150 to 300 GeV. Got it.
Adding a doublet,
two Higgs doublet model?
Yeah,
that's a different thing. You won't get this kind of phase transition because once you break the doublet, you're giving everything in a standard model a mass. So that's a whole different class. And it's actually not the simplest scalar extension that has, right, you're adding 4 degrees of freedom rather than 3. So you typically don't get this kind of two-step sort of situation.
But you can the triplet couple the fermions?
Triplet does not couple the fermions because it has no hypercharge, and so you can't write down any Yukawa interactions. So it's really all the actions in the scalar sector. So I'll make a comment about how you might augment this model a little bit to now get the CP violation in here. This potential does not have any CP violation, and that it's already interesting that you could get a second phase transition. And you might think about gravity wave production coming in a couple of ways, right? If you have with the CP violation, your first bubble here is slow enough that it's not it's a deflagration. You may not get the signal from here, but then this turns out to also be a first-order phase transition. And you're not now relying on diffusion in this step to make the baryons. This could, in principle, be a faster bubble if the parameters are right. You might get a larger gravity wave signal.
It's still at a low temperature.
What's that?
It's still at a low
They're all at the relatively low temperatures. The next scenario I'm going to discuss could be somewhat higher temperature. One to 300 GeV.
That's typically too small, right?
It depends. I mean, you are the sensitivity of the interferometer get worse, obviously, but if is strong enough.
Large alpha.
So
large alpha value, like I did.
So again, what triggers these phase transitions? So what is it? There is no negative mass parameter, right?
No, there is. There is. M0 squared is negative.
Oh, it's negative.
Yeah. I said that over here. I'll say this again. I'm going to choose it.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You have to have, right? And then it becomes just, again, a quantitative question of, you know, whether you end up here first or over here. Stability has to be satisfied. You know, there are a lot of sort of considerations, but yes.
The size
of people? Oh, order one. It's not particularly large. You know, it could be smaller. I mean, you know, the analogous statement for the standard model, if this was, this dynamics is going along the standard model, then this is lambda. Lambda has to be less than like 0.2 or something. You get the Higgs below around 40 GeV. But here, the origin of the mass is a little different. You know, this is not getting its mass from its own BEV, and so the parameters can be, there's more freedom. Way?
Well, the scalar simulator, you can do the same thing, right?
Yeah, but the scalar singlet does not help you by breaking electroweak symmetry. You want to turn off the topologically dangerous processes that change baryon numbers. Singlet, all the singlet does is for a standard model plus singlet, it increases E over 2 lambda. What this triplet is doing is it's not relying on this term, it's relying on this term being larger by effectively making this compared to this smaller. Okay, so let me talk about now a really sort of out of the box, sort of, not out of the box, but sort of, I guess it's sort of out of the box example, which is the idea that you could break a symmetry at some temperature and then cool it to a symmetry restored state.
Yeah, but the singlet can provide you that possibility of anything else.
Oh, it could, absolutely. You could add a singlet
to
this.
You delay the phase transitions.
Yeah, you could certainly add the singlet to this, absolutely. Again, I'm just trying to get the essential features, but absolutely, you know, you can, there's no reason not to. In fact, in the next example, I'm going to add a singlet. So the second example is the idea that you might have a phase transition that breaks color, SU3, and then at lower temperature, restore it. So this sounds crazy, which sort of is, but it turns out there is at least one existence proof in nature where symmetry is restored as temperature is lowered. And this comes in the, you can find it in Weinberg's 1974 paper on gauge theories at finite temperature. And apparently the story I was told is that he was having conversations with Coleman, and Coleman pointed this out to him, that there's a system in nature called Rochelle salt. And Rochelle salt has the property that as you cool it down, it becomes piezoelectric, which means it becomes more ordered, less symmetric. You cool it further down, the piezoelectricity goes away. It returns to the high temperature state. So the symmetry is broken and then restored. So Weinberg pointed out that in gauge theories, there is the possibility of the same kind of pattern. Okay. So this idea of color breaking is really not new to us, but it, you know, first goes back to the ideas of Weinberg. Later on, Paul Langacker and P or Pi, I don't know how you know what his collaborator's pronunciation was. They were worried about the production of monopoles in grand unified theories. And so to get rid of monopoles, they said, what if QED was broken at high temperature, and that would get rid of monopoles that were produced in guts, and then QED is eventually restored at lower temperature. And eventually that solution became disfavored because inflation takes care of diluting away monopoles. But they were thinking about QED. This is general. In Weinberg's paper, it's a very nice discussion of ON cross ON gauge theories. And then Goran Sinjanovic and collaborators Robbie Mohapatra, Janowicz thought about it in the context of SU5 and spontaneous CP violation. And then we've applied it to SU3C by this paper by Patel, myself, and Mark Wise a couple years ago. Okay, so let me illustrate how this works in QCD. So let's add a color triplet scaler.
So this is different from the stop case that.
Well, it could be like a stop. The problem.
We did this 15 years ago.
Many people looked at it in stops, and you never got out of the color breaking phase, is what I understood.
Right.
That's the problem.
We don't make it, yeah.
And what we were able to do is to get out of the color breaking phase. Yes. I guess I should add to this list. Carlos, Jim Klein is and others worked on it a little bit too, and everyone got stuck in color breaking. And so the problem is supersymmetry constrains the potential so much that it's a hard thing to avoid. So you definitely want to avoid color breaking in SUSY, but you don't have to, and it doesn't have to really be a stop to do the job if you're a little more generic. So let's add the color triplet scaler, which I'll call C, and I'll write down my Higgs portal operators as well as the others. So there'll be the usual standard model Higgs mass term minus mu squared h dagger h minus mu c dagger c, and then there's going to be a quartix coupling between the two, lambda hc h dagger h c dagger c, plus all the other terms that I'm not going to write down. Now I'm back on my equations, which is good. Okay, and so the simplest case is if C is a SU2 left U1 gauge singlet, but the realistic case is that it's not. So the realistic case, C is a doublet under SU2, and it has hypercharge. And the reason why you don't want a singlet is that we're going to be breaking color by giving C a VEV. And you don't want stable colored scalars to hang around. So you've got to decay them by coupling them to standard model quarks. And so one way to do that is to write down leptoquark type interactions like this, where I have, for example, a U-bar right and a left-handed lepton, where I have a left-handed quark and a right-handed lepton coupled to C. Okay. But for purposes of illustration, I'm just going to focus on the scalar potential. And so you'll see what the game is. CP phase, so for CP violation, I'll spend the last 10 minutes talking about CP violation, but in principle, CP violation would come in through this interaction here, and that's actually a project that we're working on right now to see if this works. So let's remind ourselves about these quadratic mass terms. Our mu of t squared terms will be the zero temperature term plus the thermal mass, and for the Higgs, you can calculate that. It's lambda H, Higgs self-coupling, plus lambda HC, plus there are gauge terms. I seem to have, there's the Yukawa, 3G2 squared over 16. I'll neglect the hypercharge, and there's a YT squared over 4, plus dot, dot, dot. And for the colored scalars, an analogous formula, and it's simpler. There's an SU3 contribution, and then there'll be these leptoquark couplings, which I'm not going to write down for purposes of illustration. Okay. So what you want to get color breaking and restoration is you want the T naught, or the T in this model, the T naught is the TC for the Higgs to be less than the T naught for the color scalar, so that as you're lowering temperature, you first cross this temperature and break color, and then there's another phase that gets broken symmetry at lower temperature. And in the interest of time, I'm not going to go into the details. I think I won't go into the details. But you can think about the sort of phase history in this sort of way. If I plot the value of the minima of the potential in different phases, I can sketch the phase history this way. Let's let zero be the value of the potential at the origin. And I can sketch what the value of the potential at the color breaking minimum is. So B of Bev of C and T. And the same thing for the Higgs phase. This will be the potential where the Bev of the Higgs is not zero and T. So as temperature is cooling, the lowest energy state for a while is the origin. And then the vacuum where the color is broken becomes the lowest energy state. And then the vacuum where the Higgs is the lowest energy state and the color has no VEV becomes the lowest energy state is here. So there are these different transitions. This is the color breaking transition. This is the color restoring and Higgs breaking transition. Okay. And so you can work with this model or this model plus a gauge singlet and get this kind of symmetry beam pattern to occur. And why is this potentially interesting for baryogenesis? Okay. So the reason it kind of caught my attention, just apart from the novelty of it, has to do with the interaction of the colored scalars with the fermions. So here, when C gets a VEV, C is carrying non-trivial B minus L to make this interaction B minus L invariant. But when C gets a VEV, you're breaking B and L. And so that means that when the color breaking bubbles are formed, baryon number is broken, not by the sphalerons, but by the VEV of the scalar field. And if you have CP violation, then you've got CP violation and baryon number violation and out of equilibrium, all happening through these combination of effects here. And why is this potentially interesting for you? It means that in contrast to normal electroweak baryogenesis, you're not making a left-handed charge density that biases phalerons to make baryons. You're just making the baryons directly through the spontaneous baryon number violation. And therefore, you don't need diffusion ahead of your bubble to get baryogenesis to work, in principle, which means the bubble expansion might be allowed to be fast.
So it's not really a weak baryogenesis in the sense that it doesn't use the B number violation.
It doesn't use the electroweak baryon number violation directly. I mean, it'll be there, but that's not going to be the driving mechanism. You know, if it works, and it remains to be seen if it works, it's coming through the interaction, direct interactions, and spontaneous baryon number violation.
Excuse me. So maybe I missed something. How about the mass of gluon?
Gluons become massive in that phase. And then at lower temperature, they become massless.
In low temperatures.
Right, right. So our picture, let's go back to our picture here. Here is C and here is H. So we're doing this and we're doing this. So here we have massive, a subset of the gluons become massive. It turns out that you have a residual SU2C in this phase. And everything is good in this phase here. And to our knowledge, the there's nothing that precludes a phase in the early universe where this is happening. Now you can ask about the temperatures. If I want to avoid some phenomenological constraints on these interactions, then it's useful to add a gauge singlet, it turns out. So if you add a gauge singlet, turns out the transition's occurring at somewhere around 2 TeV, so it's a higher temperature scenario. So that's a different gravity wave sort of spectrum than at the lower temperature. And just by dimensional analysis of the parameters, you see that the sphaleron is suppressed. E over lambda turns out is relatively small. So it has the ingredients, at least.
So I'm missing a little bit the physics. Once this occurs at the expectation value, this creates mass terms for these fermions that we call. So what happens, or what is the dynamics then?
So the dynamics is like an ordinary electric baryogenesis. There's going to be, there's going to be flavor asymmetry generated, okay? And that will include a color singlet baryon number violating component, baryon number non-zero component, and that if you look at the diffusion equations, will survive after the symmetry is restored. So that's why, yeah, right, because this in the realistic case has SU2 quantum numbers, so, and again, I said this probably too fast, but the parameters and the potential, when you add a singlet, you add a cubic term, the cubic term over the effective cortex is ratio to the temperature is order one, so the sphaleron energy is large, you quench the sphalerons, and so you're just doing explicit baryon number, spontaneous baryon number violation.
Just to be sure you have understood, basically, the color blocking phase transition can be even of second order.
No, you want to really turn off sphalerons, right? So we're taking it to be first order. I'm thinking, the way we're setting this up, there really is a scattering from a bubble. Now, how it would work in a second-order transition, I'm not sure.
But once you earn the bet, okay, it depends. If the mass of the dead-colored object is heavy enough to be out of equilibrium, are you getting a decay out of it, like leptogenesis?
There's in principle possible decay contributions as well.
With the baryon number.
There's also possible. It's possible. We just haven't worked that part out. We're interested to see if the interactions with the color bubble wall could generate the baryon asymmetry. But yes, there could in principle be out of equilibrium decays.
Then it could be a
second order transition. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of open sort of season on this possibility, and it's a little bizarre. Why should nature do this? But it does it at lower temperatures. So why not in the early universe?
Just a curiosity, but don't you have constraints about the color breaking phase of the universe,
time? We could not find a good, because, I wonder about this, and maybe someone knows something that I don't, about why you couldn't have a phase with massive gluons, but the temperature's so high that stuff is just going to go away, decay away by the time you get to our temperature, our phase. Okay, so we're kind of getting close to the end of the time, so I won't say anything about CP violation in the scalar sector in these scenarios. That we could do informally, but in terms of the question, what are the classes? So I tried to illustrate how these Higgs portal scenarios can give you new phase transition dynamics. I've given you a little bit of a flavor about loops. That was in the sigma case essential for getting a first order phase transition, and that'll show up in the MSSM as well. I didn't get to this part, but I think it's better if we end early rather than late. So I'll stop there. So the test would be, the essential ingredients are the coupling to the, in this case, the leptoquarks, okay, which you can certainly probe at the LHC, and then the scalar potential, you have to
say. Heavy though, right?
What's that?
Still get this.
Well, so we've made them heavy to avoid the current LHC constraints on leptoquarks. Otherwise, it's nonsensical. You could think about color octets. There, the constraints are really tight from dijet resonances. So the triplet is probably the safer.
Okay. How strong is the coupling non-IC? So you have to lift these masses eventually.
Yeah. So there is an issue.
I understand that the bare mass is negative.
Yep. So the coupling. So if I don't have the singlet parts of this, then there is a real restriction on lambda HC and therefore on the mass of the color scalar to be 500 to 800 GeV. Okay. So it's heavy, but it's in the probed range now.
So lambda is strong. Yeah.
Lambda starts to become strong, and then it becomes non-perturbative, and I don't know what to say. Okay. But if you add cubic terms, a singlet, so I can write down lambda CS, C dagger C, S squared. I can give extra contributions to the mass, push the mass up, also pushes up the phase transition temperature, and avoid the LHC constraints. And then you can write down these cubic terms as well, it turns out.
Because if not, you have a strong production of the guys decaying into leptons and jets.
Yeah. That's a leptoquark.
Very...
No, that's exactly, that's the leptoquark searches. And that's exactly what we had to worry about. And so this is the trick, is to push the mass up with a...
Because if within the context of a negative mass.
Right. You worry about the mass spectrum has to be low or your non-perturbative couplings, and so that the singlet is your rescue. Okay. Sounds like maybe I've exhausted people. So I guess we have... a break for now, and then there's Marco's talk at 4 on leptogenesis and phenomenology.
Okay. So
we're done before coffee. That was the other idea.
Just for those who care, the Netherlands beat Spain by 5-1.
Nice revenge.
5-1. I think the previous world champion.
In a triplicate, you can also include the triplet.
Yeah. So that's another case we're working on. Yeah. Then it couples to neutrino mass. Yeah. So that's another case that we're working on. It just is more degrees of freedom, which is why we didn't do it first. And there you don't have a monopole solution. So it's more realistic.
Okay.
All right.
Very nice.